Good morning, everyone. It's good to see as many of you here as are here. The roads were not the best this morning for driving in. It took me about twice as long to get here as usual. Not quite, but a lot longer than usual. We have a good schedule this morning. It's going to be interesting as well as something we need to do. So we're going to start with the Metropolitan Regional Park System. Mr. Steffrud, is he here? Ah, great, of course.
How much have you got for each of
these? Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Arnie Steffrud. I'm the manager of the Regional Parks and Natural Resources Program at the Metropolitan Council. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's budget for Metropolitan Regional Parks. I'll cover three topics today. First of all, I'll give you an overview of what the Metropolitan Regional Park System is. Second, I'll present the governor's budget for operations and maintenance of the regional park financed with general funds and natural resources fund money. And finally, I'll describe the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund budget for the Metro Regional Park System and link it to the 25-year Parks and Trails strategic plan directions. Regarding what the regional park system is, in 1974, the Metropolitan Parks Act was passed. That act directed the Metro Council to prepare a regional parks policy plan. That plan generally identifies land which should be acquired for regional parks and trails by cities, counties, and special park districts in the metro area. These regional parks and trails, together with state parks and trails, are supposed to meet the outdoor recreation needs of metropolitan area residents and visitors. The Metro Parks Act also directs the Metro Council to grant state and regional capital dollars to regional park implementing agencies to acquire land and develop park and trail units called for in the Regional Parks Policy Plan. In 1985, law was enacted that directs the Metro Council to distribute state funds to supplement local funding for regional park system operations and maintenance. So what is the regional park system? It is owned and operated by 10 regional park implementing agencies, which includes Anoka County, Ramsey County, Washington County, Dakota County, Scott County, Carver County, plus the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, the City of St. Paul, and the City of Bloomington. Three Rivers Park District oversees regional parks in suburban Hennepin County. Some of these agencies also own local parks, which are not part of the regional park system. The system, currently open to the public, encompasses 54,842 acres, and it hosted 44 million visits in 2011. There are 39 regional parks in the system, including Lake Waconia, which is managed by Carver County. Regional parks range in size from 100 to 500 acres. We also have 12 park reserves, and those park reserves are much larger. They range in size from 1,000 to 5,000 acres. An example is Rice Creek Chain of Lakes Park Reserve in Anoka County. Regional parks and park reserves offer facilities for picnicking, camping, swimming, boating, fishing, environmental education, and trail activities. In many ways, they're the state parks in the metropolitan area. There are 7 special recreation features in the regional park system. These special recreation features provide one-of-a-kind outdoor recreation and environmental education facilities and programs, such as the Como Zoo and Como Conservatory. And another example is Nuremberg Floral Gardens on the shore of Lake Minnetonka, and that is managed by Three Rivers Park District. We also have 38 regional trails currently open for use that total 308 miles, and these regional trails provide a network that provides access to regional parks and park reserves. One example is Big Rivers Regional Trail in the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers, and that's managed by Dakota County. The long-range plan is a park system that encompasses 70,000 acres and 1,000 miles of trails. The annual visits to the regional park system are estimated based upon sample counts collected each summer, plus campground registration data and special event data. This chart illustrates the amount of visitation to the regional park system from 1974, when it was at 5 million visits a year, to 2011. Which is now at 44 million visits a year. And the growth in those visits is due to three things. First of all, expansion of the regional park system with the acquisition of land and development of that land into new regional park and trail units, population growth of the region, and finally marketing of these parks and trails by regional park implementing agencies and the Metropolitan Council. These parks are regionally significant because they serve persons who live throughout the seven-county metropolitan region and visitors to the region from greater Minnesota and elsewhere. Based on our most recent research conducted in 2008, 45% of the visits to the regional park system are non-local visitors. A non-local visitor is a person who lives outside the jurisdiction of the park agency of that particular park or trail. For example, a resident of Ramsey County who visits a regional park managed by Washington County is a non-local visitor. Conversely, 55% of the visits to the regional parks and trails are local visits. Those are visits by persons who live in the jurisdiction that manages that regional park. For example, a resident of St. Paul who visits Pomo Regional Park, which is managed by the City of St. Paul, is a local visitor. Now that I provided you with a background on what the Metropolitan Regional Park System is, I'll present you the governor's budget regarding operations and maintenance of the system. In 1985, law was enacted that authorized the Metro Council to disperse state appropriations to regional park implementing agencies to supplement local property tax and user fee revenues used to finance operations and maintenance of the regional park system. The state appropriations are financed from the general fund and from the natural resources fund. A total of $145 million of state appropriations have been made from fiscal year 1986 to fiscal year 2013. And these state funds have financed 9.6% of total operations and maintenance costs during that time period. I'll now present the governor's budget recommendation for fiscal year 2014-15 in the context of the appropriation made in 2012-2013. As this bar chart indicates, the governor recommends $2.87 million a year from the general fund and $5.67 million a year from the natural resources fund for operations and maintenance. And that's the same level as the current biennium for fiscal year 12-13. To put this recommendation into context, this pie chart shows the share of calendar year 2011 Metro Regional Parks operations and maintenance expenses financed with state and local sources. The state general fund financed 3% of those costs. The natural resources fund financed 5.8% for a combined state share of 8.8%. Property taxes collected by the regional park agencies in their jurisdictions financed 73.4%, and park user fees financed 17.8% of the cost. And the total cost during that year to operate and maintain the system was $95 million. I'll conclude my presentation with an overview of the governor's budget regarding the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund appropriation. The Parks and Trails Legacy Plan has strategic directions which provide guidance on how to spend Parks and Trails Legacy money. Those strategic directions are, one, connect people to the outdoors. There are many ways to do that, including improved marketing to attract folks who are currently not visiting parks and trails, and programming for activities and events that attract new visitors. Two, acquire land, specifically parcels within existing park and trail boundaries, and also for new parks and trails in underserved areas. Three, create opportunities by developing new facilities in existing parks and new parks and trails to attract new visitors. Four, take care of what we have through the renovation of existing park and trail infrastructure, as well as restoration of natural areas and parks. And finally, work better together through cooperative planning and interagency projects. So in regards to linking those strategic directions to the governor's recommended budget of $32,394,000, this pie chart shows how that would be done. $886,000, or 2.74%, would be spent on projects that connect people to the outdoors. $18.6 million, or 57.5%, would be spent to create opportunities by building new park and trail facilities. $6.24 million, or 19.3%, would be spent on taking care of what we have, $105,000 on working better together, and then $6.53 million, or 20%, would be used to acquire land. The $33,394,000 of Parks and Trails Legacy Funds would leverage a significant amount of non-state sources, as this pie chart indicates. Over $25 million of federal trail grants would be leveraged with this money, plus $3,887,000 of Metro Council bonds and park agency funds for land acquisition projects. So the total investment is $61,465,000.
Mr. Stepford, could you just hold for a minute? Representative Hansen has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. maybe this is a question for the Chair. When the DNR comes with the state parks, I think the pie chart before this one where you had the budget-linked connect people to the outdoors, create opportunities, take care of what we have, acquire land, it'd be good to have that same pie chart from the DNR so we could compare where they're priority, so if we can get that when they come. And then, Madam Chair, I have to attend another meeting, so I'm going to be excused. I'd like to ask to be excused from this meeting.
Well, you have already been here, Representative Hansen. People do come and go. Yes, I think we will make sure we get this information. This is going to be one of the things that we're going to spend more time talking about later. We're just having an introduction now. But what we don't have is a long-term. We have got long-term plans for everything, members, and no long-term financial plans. So that's one of the things that we will have some conversations about. If you want to continue.
Yes, thank you. As this pie chart shows, Parks and Trails legacy funds would finance 53% of that total investment of $61 million, with the remaining financed with non-state sources of 47%. To summarize the outcomes of this investment, 85 acres of land would be acquired approximately, and that's a projection because part of this money is going to be used to buy land from willing sellers, and we can't give you an exact amount of acreage at this point in time, but based upon past appropriations and the amount that's proposed here, this is what we think will happen. There would be 12 projects that would replace worn-out park facilities, taking care of what we have, as well as developing new parks and trails, creating new opportunities. And specifically, there'd be 4 miles of existing regional trails would be rehabilitated, and 31 miles of new regional trails would be constructed. Four environmental education and volunteer programs would be continued. We use legacy money since its inception in 2009 for these programs. And 3 natural resource management programs would be continued using Conservation Corps of Minnesota crews. Excuse me. And the projects at these parks and trails, based upon annual visitation estimates that we currently have for where these projects would be located, would be at parks and trails that had 19.4 million visits in 2011. We're also looking at developing or acquiring land for new parks and trails, and the estimated visits yet to be determined, but based upon comparable parks like these, we figure that there will be about 1.8 million visits to those new parks and trail facilities in a year. Now, the money that goes to the Metro Council is distributed to 10 regional park implementing agencies under a formula in state law. And this slide shows how that money is distributed. 35% of the appropriation, or I should say 90% of that appropriation, is divided among the 10 park agencies. And within that 90%, 35% of that is based upon the share of each agency's population compared to the region's population as a whole. 20% is based upon the number of annual visits that park agency hosts relative to total annual visits to the system. 20% is based upon the amount that park agency spent annually to operate and maintain its portion of the regional park system. 15% is based upon the amount of non-local visits that agency hosts compared to all non-local visits to the system. And 10% is based upon the amount of land that park agency manages. Now, as I said, the remaining 10% of the appropriation is used to buy property. And that money, it must be matched, where every dollar of legacy funds is matched with $1.20 of Metro Council bonds and non-state funds provided by the regional park agency that's acquiring the property. Park acquisition grants are awarded when land is available to purchase from willing sellers based upon negotiations from certified appraisals. So the amount each of the 10 implementing agencies would receive is shown on this graph here. Anoka County would receive $2.78 million, Bloomington $556,000, Carver County Parks, $567,000, Dakota County, $2.26 million, Three Rivers Park District, $7.06 million, the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, $6.2 million, Ramsey County, $2.5 million, St. Paul, $4.58 million, Scott County, $1.06 million, and Washington County, $1.58 million. Now, at the back of your handout, there are a detailed list of all the projects that would be funded. It's broken down by implementing agency, as well as the federal trail grants that are being matched, and the front page of that shows, you know, the agency amount, federal trail grants being leveraged, and then in the case of land acquisition, the amount of match to the legacy dollars from the Metro Council and from the park agencies. So I'll conclude with some examples of past projects funded with Parks and Trails legacy funds. Eastman Nature Center in Elm Creek Park Reserve was essentially renovated and expanded using a number of appropriations from the legacy fund over the past several bienniums. Construction at Spring Lake Regional Park in Scott County is being funded with several grants from legacy dollars. Here's an example in the upper right-hand corner of a trail in that park. And then Conservation Corps crews, as we said, have been used for natural resource management programs. And this picture in the lower right corner is a crew in Anoka County doing bare root tree planting at Bunker Hills Regional Park. So that concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Members, I think it's worthwhile to take a glance at the lists of what will be purchased with this money. I think Met Council does a fine job in letting us know and letting citizens know where their dollars will be going, and this is what we should be expecting as we go forward from all other folks who are asking for dollars. So good job, good model. I want to go back to your page 5 where you say state funds finance 9.6% of total operation and maintenance cost. Would you have the same expectation after the acquiring of getting the legacy dollars that you're getting that you will be able to maintain a 90% funding of this system without a request to us?
Madam Chair, the state funds for operations and maintenance are just a separate budget category, and as I said, over the fiscal year 1986 to fiscal year 2013, the appropriations compared to the operations cost, state money financed 9.6% of that total. The trend is going down. It's not at 9.6% in the slide that I did show you. From the 2011 calendar year, the state share was 8.8% for that particular year. And with the amount proposed of $2.87 million of general fund money and $5.67 million from the Natural Resources Fund per year for the next biennium, and that's the same as this biennium, I can't forecast exactly what the agencies will be spending on operations and maintenance. But because the state support is the same from one buy-in to the next, the share of state support for the system costs will probably creep down a little bit because of inflation.
I understand that, and if you add the legacy money that you will be getting, would you expect to see the same?
Well, the legacy dollars typically don't finance operating expenses. There are some things here that are done that way, but there's two separate budgets, really.
No, that's not my question. If you do the acquisition, et cetera, from the legacy budget, mm-hmm. when you come back to us, will your request for state dollars for operation and maintenance be relatively the same as it is right now?
Madam Chair and members, yes, probably will be.
Okay. Wait, I don't have the exact numbers, but we're looking at, relatively speaking, it will be about 10% or less.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. We are going to have a longer discussion about this issue later on. I mean, these things later on, but certainly want clarifying questions right now. And who's the first one? Oh, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to understand. They're going to come back before us when?
Well, we will have a discussion of the park's legacy dollars altogether. So let's divide this in two pieces. And the governor's request as the regular budget is, I think we just ask any questions you want. And the other, though, as we have discussions, we will have discussions about that other portion later. Okay. Is that suitable?
Yes. Well, then I'll start with my question. Thank you for being here, Mr. Steffarud. I'm curious. This is a substantially different recommendation from the governor than 2 years ago. Can you talk about the governor's recommendation of 2 years ago and the governor's recommendation currently?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, 2 years ago, the general fund and natural resources fund budget recommendation from the governor, I believe, was what was appropriated, but I need to check. And then in regards to Parks and Trails legacy appropriations,
I think the chair wanted to keep on track with not legacy, so I was
okay,
concerned about. Do you not have it, or maybe our fiscal analyst has the governor's recommendation from 2 years ago? Because this is a completely different turnaround for the governor. I'm glad the governor is interested in what we ended up doing, but the chair has specifically talked about comparing it, and I'm wondering what's changed in the governor's recommendation from 2 years ago, because there was quite a different recommendation from the governor 2 years ago.
I think we can get that information. I think that's...
Well, Madam Chair, is someone going to be here to answer it, or are we just going to talk about it? I mean, that's okay, but if they're not coming back, I guess I would like to...
We will ask folks back. Don't.
Okay, so I just want to... It was a completely different recommendation from the governor 2 years ago, and I'd like to understand how he was going to run the department back then and how all of a sudden things are different today and we're enlightened. I mean, was it actually 2 years ago we were supposed to save your park system and jack up the funding like we ended up doing? Or what's the new change today that all of a sudden the governor's seen the light in regards to Metro Parks? And I thought that's what we were here to talk about.
You can talk.
Well, it doesn't seem like anybody even knows what the budget numbers were from 2 years ago, the recommendation from the governor. Are we hiding from it? I'd be embarrassed. It was an embarrassing number. We should at least know it.
And I apologize for not having that information here.
Well, that's a convenient not having it, because I wouldn't want to have it either. I can actually go up my office and get it if we want, Madam Chair.
Do you want to just share with us, Representative McNamara, what you think it might have been?
Right. Madam Chair, it was millions less. And I'm not sure, we don't have Mr. Reinholds here to pull it up, but I don't bring my computer to the hearing, but somebody could probably find it, and I'd be surprised if nobody, I'm assuming I haven't looked and glanced through the audience, but I'd imagine the lobbyists for the regional parks are here system, and they probably could answer it relatively quickly. I don't want to speak what the number was, I just remember it was embarrassingly low.
I think, since the governor's, as you are intimating, has seen the light, I think it would be good to get the numbers, and if you get the numbers to us today, we will get them emailed around to everybody today.
Madam Chair, I have one other one for the system. I think it's interesting, the system, we have this discussion about Metro Parks, state parks, regional parks. But what we're missing, what about cities like Richfield or Cottage Grove or Hastings? Richfield, Cottage Grove, and Hastings would be regional centers if they were outstate Minnesota, eligible for significant regional funding. We don't get any Metro Parks funding to speak of. But you drew a line at Bloomington and you cut out communities like Richfield, Cottage Grove, Hastings. our water park in Hastings that the citizens of Hastings pay for on a summer day attracts many residents from outside the city of Hastings, probably more than the percentages, I think, possibly that you talk about. Why don't you expand your metro parks to really include the entire metropolitan area?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, as this system has been developed, we've tried to make it comparable to what the state parks are like. So it's natural resource based, and your example of the water park, that's an artificial facility in the city of Hastings. There are comparable ones in other municipalities, and they may and likely do attract people from outside the municipality, and those municipalities typically charge a non-local resident fee that's higher to cover the expense for those people that are coming from outside the political jurisdiction, since those folks are not paying a local property tax. But in regards to why the city of Bloomington specifically is a regional park implementing agency and other cities are not, they own and manage a portion of a large park reserve, Highland Bush Anderson Lakes Park Reserve. A portion of it is in Normandale, and the land surrounding Bush Lake are managed by the city of Bloomington. And then Highland Lake and Anderson Lakes, and it's all one unit that's over 2,000 acres in size. That's managed by Three Rivers Park District. So, and there's been a joint a powers agreement, if you will, and joint management of that park unit by both of them. But we specifically provide grants to the city of Bloomington for its portion of that park reserve, and that's why it's a regional park implementing agency. Now, Hastings and Cottage Grove and Richfield are other municipalities, and they have, in some instances, some large parks that may be over 100 acres in size. But because we have distributed these other regional parks throughout the metropolitan area, those municipalities get service from the nearby regional park, and there is has been a local recreation grants program where the state has helped municipalities for local park facilities to provide some state support there. So we've tried to be holding the line of this. Primarily, regional parks are managed by counties and large cities. And we have used natural resources as the basis for siting these parks. Most of them are on lakes or rivers. And finally, they are providing large-scale facilities that serve thousands of people at a time and attract folks from outside the political jurisdiction that manages that unit. So we've tried to distinguish the regional park system from these local facilities.
Madam Chair, I'll just ask one more. So I'm trying to understand. So the city of Minneapolis, the city of St. Paul, don't use any of this money for their local parks. Each one of them have a number of neighborhood parks. So none of this money is used in Minneapolis or St. Paul for their neighborhood parks. It only goes out to Theodore Worth or somewhere like that. None of it's used in the small neighborhood parks, either the park board or St. Paul Rec runs.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, that is correct.
So it's only used in their bigger, more expansive parks, and all their other parks are funded somewhere else.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, that's correct.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Last question, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Representative McNamara's point on the funding from 2 years ago, if we could get that in the form of a side-by-side so we can compare apples to apples and so forth. I do have one other question, just in general. You know, we see this long list of projects that are here. Thank you, Mr. Steffrud, for being here. I'm just curious to know about who makes these decisions. This is the plan that you're coming forward with. Who's on the committee? Who has final approval? You know, are they appointed? Are they elected? Give me a rundown, please.
Madam Chair, Representative, the decisions made for which projects are on that list are made by the Park Agency's policy board, either county commissioners who are elected, city council members in the case of the city of Bloomington, or Three Rivers Park District members who are also elected.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So going back to what Representative McNamara was addressing, some of the other areas, the Cottage Grove and so forth, do they have representation in that committee? I mean, obviously, that those areas are part of the Met Council, as I understand it.
Madam Chair, the council members are appointed by the governor, but as I said, the decisions as to what projects are on these on the list by implementing agency are made by local elected officials. And in the case of these county park agencies, you know, they those county commissioners represent districts that include cities. And in the case of the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, it's a separate entity of government, if you will, that has districts that are representing people in those districts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stepford, for coming.
Thank you.
We're going to move right along now to the County Geologic Atlas Program. Dale Setterholm. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Dale Setterholm. I'm the Associate Director of the Minnesota Geological Survey at the University of Minnesota. I'm here to talk to you today about the County Geologic Atlas Program. In a nutshell, this is a cooperative effort. The Minnesota Geological Survey produces a package of maps and associated databases that describe where aquifers occur in Minnesota and their connections both to the land surface and to surface water features. Our colleagues at the Department of Natural Resources then produce a similar package of maps and databases that document water levels, natural water composition, water age, and aquifer sensitivity to contamination. The atlases are an essential part of what I would call a consensus process on sustainable water management that's been developed in recent years. I've simplified that process here from a very technical document down to this more simple one, but it begins with defining a management area, and we try to find an area. We set boundaries that either have no flow across the boundaries or have a flow that's readily estimatable. Then within the study area, you would characterize the hydrologic system, then compare the available quantity and quality of water against the needs of the community there. From that, you would develop a water allocation plan, allocate the available water, and then monitor the situation and revise it as necessary going forward. Geologic atlases are essential to most of the major steps in that process. We begin with the definition of the management area. We need to know hydrologic conditions to choose an area that's manageable. Then characterizing the hydrologic system, obviously the geologic maps and hydrologic maps are essential to that. That middle step, the comparison of available needs or available quantity and quality against needs is a budgeting operation. You figure out how much water there is and budget it out to where it can be used. Then when you get into the water allocation plan, for example, the county well index element of county geologic atlases shows us the distribution of wells within the management area, who's using which aquifers, how much is being used, and so it's a very useful tool for that step. And then finally, the monitoring of the system beyond this exercise. Geologic atlases are very helpful in designing a monitoring program that not only tells us about changes, but helps us identify why those changes are taking place.
Just excuse me for a moment. Representative Erickson, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. You said the define the management area, and I look at the atlas coverage. Is the management area not specific counties, or are they the management area different from the existing counties, or I'm just a bit confused on that.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do the atlases on a county by county basis, and I think that It began that way because county water plans, everything is written at a county level. But all of these maps fit with the ones adjacent to them. And when we get to this process is not yet in place. This is what all the state agencies have talked about doing. We will pick management areas that don't necessarily have those political boundaries. It might be a particular aquifer or a group of aquifers, depending on what the need is. Beyond that sustainable management exercise, atlases are put to a variety of applications on an everyday basis. And this includes decisions on water appropriation and many other permits. Atlases are also useful in wellhead protection. So the agencies and the local communities that are responsible for wellhead protection plans use these documents to come up with those designs. As I said, I think the atlases are essential in meaningful monitoring. You can always drill a well and watch the water level and watch the water quality. But if it changes, you need to understand the flow path of that water to understand what caused those changes and to be able to come up with solutions to that. The atlases are very useful in simulation of new pumping outcomes or other kinds of changes. What I'm referring to here is hydrologists are able to describe the reaction of the water system to pumping through mathematical equations, and we use these in a computer model. So if a city is anticipating putting in a new well, you can actually simulate what the effects of that well will be on the system. Will it affect a nearby trout stream? Will it affect a fen, something like that? And so we can proactively look at that situation and come up with the best possible solution. The atlases are also useful for efficient remediation. They've certainly been put to use with the PFOA problem in the Lake Elmo area and many other spill response efforts across the state. I would suggest atlases are useful for land use planning. If you identify an area as particularly susceptible to contamination or realize that it's an area that contributes water to a municipal well, there's an opportunity to put that land into use as a park or some use that will not then affect the water quality in a negative way. Atlases have also been used to focus spending, both on a statewide and local level. For example, you could look at a county atlas, use the county well index file for that atlas, and identify what part of the county are there particularly shallow or vulnerable wells. And then if the county is going to put money into improvements in septic systems, that's the place where their limited funds will have the greatest effect. This program has been around as long as I've been at the Geological Survey, so that's 30-some years. 25 counties have been completed. 11 are underway currently, which leaves 51 that have not yet been addressed. There are 3 updates either completed or underway, and I would say another 4 are probably appropriate. The average cost of Part A, that's the part that the Minnesota Geological Survey does of each atlas, averages about $350,000 per county. It varies greatly. Obviously, a county the size of St. Louis County would be a different picture than a very small county. But they're also affected by the amount of data available and other variables. But that's a good average number. We do updates for a couple of reasons. One is some of the older atlases are non-digital. They're not useful in those formats and need to be updated for that reason. In other cases, it's just that there's been so much growth that it's created a lot of new data and we can make a much better map. I've been in discussions with Hennepin County. When we made their atlas in 1984, we used about 6,000 well records to make that atlas. There are now an additional 15,000 records available to support mapping. So you can imagine a much higher resolution map that would be more effective. One part of the state that has not yet received atlas attention is the Arrowhead region. And with the potential for changes in mining in that area, it's been suggested both by citizens and others that it may be appropriate to get atlases done in that area. We recognize that it's a unique geologic setting, quite unlike places where we've done atlases in the past. And for that reason, I'm contemplating a pilot project, not taking on an entire county at one time, but taking on a smaller part of a county, testing the methods appropriate for this unique setting, finding out which ones work the best, which products would be most useful to the kinds of evaluations going on up there, and also what the costs would be. I'll just work through this cross-sectional view. This is just kind of a generic view of the geology of Minnesota. Everywhere in Minnesota at some depth, there are igneous and metamorphic rocks that are not aquifers. They are the bottom of the hydrologic system. In the southeastern part of the state, southeastern third or so, including the metro, we have a sequence of layered sedimentary rocks on top of that crystalline bedrock, and many of those formations are aquifers and are useful as a water supply. Over the rest of the state, we rely on glacial sediment that lies on top of the bedrock. Some of that sediment is aquifer material, and much of it is not. When we look at the Arrowhead region, that mass of bedrock that is for the most part not aquifers is actually very near or at the land surface in many parts of that region. And so the hydrologic system is exceedingly thin and mostly confined to patchy and discontinuous bodies of glacial sediment on top of it. Other differences are in that part of the state, the population density is much lower, so we don't have that database of water well records, or the database of water well records will be much sparser. That is our basic data element. So the information we need to create maps will have to be obtained in other ways. It may be geophysical methods, it may be shallow drilling on our part, or other things, but we think it's appropriate to go in there and do a pilot study and learn exactly what will work the best in that area. The Geologic Atlas Program is not the only geologic mapping program that's worked in Minnesota. And this map shows the extent of bedrock mapping beyond the areas that we've done county atlases. And you can see the Arrowhead area is almost completely mapped in terms of bedrock geology. It's the material on top of that that has not yet been mapped. This is a map of mapping the glacial sediments at the land surface, and you can see here the Arrowhead, very little has been done compared to other parts of the state. I would point out that polygon that's kind of lined up with the Mesabi Range up there. That was a geologic atlas-like study funded by LCCMR several years ago. And that actually covers the area of the PolyMet proposal that's under consideration. And so I'm discussing this with people who are involved in that process and finding out, were those products exactly what they needed for that operation? And if not, what would be the appropriate products? Finally, and I think you have a separate color handout that is probably larger than the PowerPoint one. This is a scenario for finishing county geologic atlases statewide. It shows that as recently as 2006, we were operating on only a couple $100,000 a year. With LCCMR help and some contracts with DNR and also some federal cost sharing, we're now operating at a little over $1 million a year, which enables us to turn out about 3 atlases per year. Each one takes a number of years to get done. But by working on multiple projects, our rate of accomplishment now is about 3 per year. Looking into the future, if I continued to get level funding from DNR and from federal cost-sharing programs, I've ramped up the funding to $1,750,000 a year, which would allow us to complete 51 new atlases and 4 updates with funding over a period of about 11 years. The gap then between the anticipated funding and what it would take to complete atlases at that newer rate of 5 per year is about $13 million over 11 years, including the funding in hand or pending that that steady funding. It's about a $19 million investment to complete the state. So that's the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to field any questions.
Members. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My county has an atlas. It's a very valuable tool, and thank you for doing that. Going back to your slide on our page 2 about sustainable water management, and I get the mapping thing, that scientific and hydrology, but when you get into the area of quantifying the needs in the area for water, part of my district has light soil and a lot of irrigation, for example. In a dry year, the irrigators run a lot. In a wet year, they run hardly at all. So how do you judge when you have intermittent water use like that in terms of water sustainability?
Madam Chair, Representative, it would be a little presumptuous of me to answer that as the allocation of water is not part of the atlases. We're kind of mapping out the plumbing system and then letting the people who do that work do what they do. But I would tell you the inputs to a budget like that are average precipitation. You know, you're looking at things over time. In Minnesota, precipitation is our only source of water. There are no rivers flowing into Minnesota. They only flow out. So we look at that input rate over time, look at the storage capacity of the aquifers that are there. Aquifers might be thought of as your savings account. In a dry year, you're drawing more out of them than you're putting in, and then in wet years, hopefully you're catching up. And so that kind of a budgeting process goes on. And the other part about irrigation permits is you always look for interference with other water uses. Each water use has a specific priority level, and they work things out that way.
Representative Anderson, DNR is going to be doing a presentation on theirs this next Tuesday, Thursday, and I think that the waters part is scheduled for Tuesday night. So you'll get a better answer to your question. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sederholm, I'm sorry if you've covered this already, but are there changes in the technology that's available to you to compile these atlases?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I can give you two examples of new technology that have made a big difference for us, and one is just geographic information systems. Maps used to be made with a fine caliber ink pen and a sheet of Mylar, a very labor-intensive process to get all the data on a sheet, then put an overlay on it, draw the contacts. All of that is now done in a GIS system. And not only does it allow us to make maps in a more efficient way, it allows you to remake the map in many, many different ways just by focusing on parts of the data within it. For example, a glacial map, the geologist has one piece of paper. He tries to convey the age of the material, the type of material, is it clay or sand, what direction did it come from, what glacier was it associated with, and they get all of that on one piece of paper because that was the only way to do it. Well, now we can parse that data out and select any part of it, and so we can make a map that just shows you where's there clay versus sand versus silt. Take all the other information out of it so we can custom make maps. Another example of technology improvements is the use of seismic geophysical surveys. This used to be done with dynamite as a source or with enormous trucks that bounce up and down on the ground to send the signal into the ground. We now have a unit about the size of a shoebox. We hook it up to a laptop, you set it down on the ground, and just the ambient energy of traffic and wind and the motion of the earth is enough for us to get a signal, and we can now get seismic readings from something like that. The outcome of this is that $350,000 number that I quoted you is about the same as it was in 1985. And I view that as an accomplishment. If we've been able to hold those costs level by bringing in better technology, I think that's good for all of us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this technology you described allow you to identify the how much water is in these aquifers?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, that geophysical method would not. I do know DNR uses different technologies in monitoring wells, vibrating wire technology and things to measure water levels and record water levels continuously. So I'm sure they're applying newer technology as well. But I'm not aware of a method that allows you to see how much water is in the aquifer without accessing the aquifer with a well and actually measuring water levels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One final question. The atlases that are completed and were completed some time ago, they require updating then, I assume, to bring them up to the same technological level as the new atlases. What's the cost? Have you got a cost estimate for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, we've only done two updates. We did Scott County, and we're currently working on Winona County, and I think I'm missing one. It's maybe three. Scott County, that update cost about $200,000, and that was the very first atlas ever done. It was published in about 1980. So it was 30 years old by the time it was redone, and that was strictly a paper document. It had no computer files or anything associated with it. I think as we move forward to atlases that were not quite as old, those costs probably come down, although, you know, you look at Hennepin County, if I made maps with 6,000 wells and now I'm going to make a map with 15,000 wells, I almost have to redo everything. So I think the costs will be close to what a new atlas would be. So it varies by county.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I think this is probably one of the most interesting pieces of what we do, and we will see the other side of it on Tuesday night. So just keep this in mind. You may want to keep this in your folder. We will now have the Department of Health, and they are, we do not have their regular budget, obviously, but the clean water money is in our jurisdiction to start with, and so that's what we're going to hear about.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Kelly. I am the Manager of Environmental Surveillance and Assessment with the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm here along with my colleagues to present the Clean Water Fund funded programs within the Environmental Health Division to describe our programs and present the governor's budget for the next biennium. And I appreciate the opportunity for us being here to do that today and for sharing this information with you. This slide shows basically the history of the clean water funded programs within the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. Starting in fiscal year 10 and 11, when funds first became available, we had two programs that were funded, the Drinking Water Contaminants of Emerging Concern program and the Source Water Protection Enhancement program that my colleagues and I will describe for you further. You can see the funding levels that we began with in that biennium. In the next biennium, which is the current biennium, fiscal years 12 and 13, we added an additional two programs that were funded around the sealing of wells around the state, unused wells, abandoned wells around the state, and then as well as enhancements to the county well index program. You heard mention of well records and well borings in the previous presentation. The county well index is often the source of those records that are used for a number of applications around the state, including the county geologic atlases. So you'll hear more about that program as well. Lastly, for the coming biennium, fiscal years 14 and 15, we have an additional two programs that we're proposing in the governor's budget that you'll also hear a little bit more about. First of all, I want to describe the program that's within the section that I manage, which is the Drinking Water Contaminants of Emerging Concern program. And I thought I'd just briefly start with some of the rationale for why the program was created to begin with. It starts with the fact that society uses a lot of chemicals. There are some 42,000 chemicals or more currently used in commerce, as well as an additional 40,000 polymers and other chemicals that are used in the manufacture of various products. So there's a lot of chemicals that are out there. Science is getting better and better at looking for and finding these chemicals in the environment, in the air, in the water, soil, and other media, including biological organisms. So we're looking for these chemicals in more places as a result of scientific research and other regulatory efforts. We also have better laboratory analytic tools that allow us to achieve lower and lower detection limits. So we're able to see these chemicals in these various media at lower and lower levels. And subsequently, questions were asked about what is the meaning of finding these chemicals, where they're being found, and at the levels they're being found. In addition, we have new ways to measure the toxicity of chemicals. The science of toxicology has grown by leaps and bounds in the last 20 years. We're looking at more and more different or mechanisms of toxicity when it comes to both humans and animals, looking for subtler and subtler effects. At lower and lower doses, we're able to see these things. And so that's brought a lot of additional information to our understanding of what it means to be exposed to chemicals in the environment. Now, to counter that, we've only traditionally had toxicity data on a limited number of chemicals. And subsequently, both nationally here in Minnesota, we've only been able to develop drinking water advice, human health-based drinking water advice, on at most a few hundred chemicals. So contrasted that with the fact that there are tens of thousands of chemicals out there in the environment and in commerce, that's in part why this program was created, to help address that gap. So the Contaminants of Emerging Concern program allows us to look at substances that have been released to or detected in Minnesota waters, either groundwater or surface water, as we know the two are connected, and surface waters are also used as a source of drinking water for the population. We also look at places where chemicals can be found that have the potential to migrate to Minnesota water, so that they're out in the environment. They may not yet have been detected in water, but they're looking that there's a likelihood that they soon will be. Chemicals are brought to our attention through a nomination process. We work with our partner agencies, with the public, with advocacy groups, with others who are interested in nominating chemicals for us to potentially look at. So it's a very open process. The guidance that we develop not only can inform public health decisions and decisions about the quality of drinking water, but also are used to guide research that's done by our partner agencies, by other organizations who are engaged in activities using clean water funds and other funds as well. And also, most importantly, can be used as a tool to educate the public about what it means when these chemicals are found in the environment, and to try to put that in some context. We're also using it more and more to help propel action with regards to these chemicals in the environment, and I'll be touching on that more in a minute. In terms of the first two cycles of funding for the Drinking Water Contaminants of Emerging Concern program, I wanted to touch a little bit on the outcomes that we've been able to achieve with this funding. In our first biennium, we were able to develop health-based guidance for the first 10 chemicals that we looked at. We also developed a baseline needs assessment, looking at the communication needs for this program, trying to figure out what are the best ways to help educate the public and our partners about these contaminants and what it means when they're found in the environment. Lastly, we developed a screening and prioritization protocol that allows us to address the most pressing concerns first, sorting through the nominated chemicals and addressing the ones that we and our partners feel are most important to address. In the second biennium of funding, we screened an additional 20-plus chemicals, looking at what their potential is for human health impacts. We're developing health-based guidance for an additional 10 chemicals. We've also, through contracted work, looking at alternatives to our current risk assessment methods. Developing health-based guidance can be a timely process, depending on the nature of the chemical, and we're actively looking for alternative methods to allow us to speed the process up so we can start to catch up with the amount of chemicals that are out in the environment and develop health-based guidance at a faster pace. We're also looking at new ways of evaluating the relative sources of these exposure to these chemicals. Because we're looking at additional forms of chemicals that we didn't traditionally look at with our other programs, things like pharmaceuticals, personal care products, drinking water is not necessarily the only form of exposure that folks might have to these chemicals. They're also using these products actively in their homes and even on their bodies, so we need to have ways to account for that. So that research has been very important. Also, we're developing and have put out outreach and education grants to further the impact of this program. to develop further media messages and targeted messages for folks who are might be interested in learning more about this. We're also looking at developing information in additional languages, and most importantly, promoting and supporting the collection of pharmaceutical and hazardous materials in an effort to try to keep these chemicals from getting into the environment in the first place. Getting information in the hands of people who want to take action so that these chemicals won't end up in the environment in the first place. Lastly, our program is now fully staffed, and that's taken a number of years to get up to speed. We compete for folks, the scientists that we need to do this work with industry, and it's taken a while to get that program fully going. Just briefly, I know this list is hard to see, but this is just a list of the chemicals that have been nominated so far for the program. We're up to, I think, 57 different chemicals, and the bolded and underlined chemicals are the ones that, through our prioritization process, we've developed actual guidance for and published that guidance, along with other guidance that we developed through our other programs. And they're arranged for a variety of chemicals, and rather than dwell on this particular list, the next slide shows the categories of chemicals that we've had nominated and developed guidance for. Things like pesticides, metals, pharmaceuticals, personal care products, flame retardants, various detergents, antimicrobial compounds. These are the chemicals that folks have expressed concern about that we focused on and are developing health-based guidance around. Lastly, for my particular program, I wanted to touch on our funding proposal for the coming biennium. We propose to continue our current efforts to screen and develop health-based guidance for these drinking water contaminants of new concern. We're also going to be expanding the capacity of our public health laboratory, which is an excellent laboratory, but expanding their capabilities for analyzing and researching these contaminants. Often they require specialized laboratory methods to detect, and there are implications that go along with that when we're looking for these chemicals in the environment, where their expertise will play a very valuable role, not only for the health department, but for our other partner agencies who are engaged in research and monitoring of these contaminants in groundwater and surface water around the state. We'll continue to test alternative risk characterization and assessment methods, so getting at new methodologies to allow us to get through this backlog of chemicals in a faster way. We're going to be increasing the coordination and collaboration with other clean water funded programs so we can deliver a more comprehensive message about the meaning of finding these chemicals in the environment, not only from a human health standpoint, but from an ecological toxicity standpoint. Sometimes chemicals that we are looking at, we may find, at least at the current time, they're not as much a concern in drinking water, but that doesn't mean they're not a concern for the aquatic environment or other environments where these chemicals may be found. Lastly, we're going to increase and provide additional outreach and education grants on these contaminants that also will result, as I mentioned, in meaningful actions to prevent these chemicals from getting in the environment and allow people to take personal action to reduce the amount of these chemicals that are being used in the state. And with that, I'm going to conclude my presentation. We'll be here for questions later on, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, Randy Ellenbow, who's the manager of drinking water protection within the Environmental Health Division.
Before you continue, I think Representative Benson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Before you do move on, I'm just wondering, does the Minnesota Department of Health have any enforcement powers when there are introductions of new pesticides, herbicides, pharmaceuticals, and so United States, if I understand, is kind of unusual in that the development introduction of new chemical compounds into the environment is reliant on the manufacturers, where in many other countries manufacturers have to get a clearance from a government agency before they introduce these products. So I'm just wondering, does the Minnesota Department of Health have any ability to stop the introduction of a compound which you find particularly potentially harmful to humans or to aquatic life or the environment generally?
Madam Chair, Representative, the Health Department does not have regulatory authority in that particular regard. The values that we develop through this program are advisory values. They can be used in rulemaking or in programs that are run by other agencies, but the department itself does not have any regulatory authorities in that particular area.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the first page, you talked about county well index. When I was out campaigning, I ran into a rather crusty old gentleman that had been digging wells for years, and he mentioned something about how he was being required to turn over his data on all the wells that he had drilled. Is that part of that county well index or something like that, or how was this your agency or whatever that was dealing with him? I'm just point of information.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I may defer that question to my colleague, Chris Elverum, who's the manager of the Well Management Program, if I might.
Madam Chair and committee members, yes, the Health Department does regulate wells and borings constructed in the state, and they are required to submit the well log to us as part of that program.
And when did that start?
1974 was when the well code first went into place.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want to continue with the next part of the presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Randy Ellingbow. I'm the manager of the Section of Drinking Water Protection at the Department of Health, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present information on the governor's proposal to continue our efforts to accelerate the development of public water supply source water protection plans and also to provide grants for implementations of those plans. Public water suppliers are required to develop plans to avoid contamination and protect groundwater sources of drinking water. That is, specifically, they're required to prepare wellhead protection plans. And the Department of Health provides technical assistance for the development of those plans to the public water suppliers. And we've also been able to work with them to implement source water protection plans through the grants program. And the Clean Water Fund, which we first received back in the first biennium, has allowed us to accelerate the rate of development of source water protection plans in order to meet our goal of completing all of these plans by 2020. And I'll show a graph in just a minute about our progress on that. And, of course, plans are only helpful if they're actually implemented, and the Clean Water Fund has allowed us to provide grants to the public water suppliers to implement those plans, and I'll provide some examples in just a minute. We do have a slight request. This is our third biennium to request funding, and we're looking for a slight request, a slight increase in this biennium.
I think folks are having a bit of a...
All right. Sorry. Thank you. We are looking at a slight increase in our proposal this time in order to increase our grants program for the future. So is there anything that would be helpful to repeat if
no.
others?
No,
okay,
we'll
thank
ahead.
You. Just to touch briefly on the history of the plan, back in the late 1990s, we began providing technical assistance to public water suppliers to develop these wellhead protection plans. And over the course of 10 or 15 years, while we were able to provide a lot of assistance, it did look like we were on about a 40-year cycle in order to get all of those prepared. And given that these need to be revised every 10 years, that was a pace that we weren't happy with. And so we did put in the proposal for funding, which was approved. And starting in 2010, we were able to greatly accelerate the rate of development of these plans for public water suppliers. There's about 935 public water suppliers, community public water suppliers across the state, like municipalities. Who are receiving technical assistance for this. And again, our goal is to have all of the plans for those public water supplies developed by the year 2020. And we do need to revise those periodically as things change in the environment, as wells are drilled. And so while developing new plans, we're also revising old plans as we go along. again, one of the things that has been very helpful to the public water suppliers is the grants that have been made available through clean water funding. Since May of 2010, we've provided 241 grants to public water suppliers all across Minnesota. Roughly two-thirds of that funding has gone to greater Minnesota and about a third in the metro area here. And it's been a very popular program with the public water supplies, and part of the reason for our request for increase, well, no, not part of the reason, actually the whole reason for our request for increase in funding for this next biennium has to go, is that it would go towards grants, because our amount available has, the demand for that has exceeded the amount available. So, and just very briefly, some of the things that those grants have gone towards is well sealing, updating potential contamination source inventories held by the public water supplies, doing things like providing assistance to property owners to manage contamination sources on their properties, and allow communities to improve their spill response capabilities. And so a wide diversity of activities, but we think very helpful in regard to the implementation of these wellhead protection plans. So thank you. That's the end of my presentation.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question? We'll go now into the county well index.
Yes, Madam Chair, Chris Elbrum, well management section manager at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm going to talk about three proposals that we have for the Clean Water Fund, the first one being the county well index. The County Well Index is a database that's managed by the Health Department as well as the Minnesota Geological Survey, and contains over 450,000 well records in the state. And to answer the representative's question, yes, when those well records come in from the contractors, they do end up in the County Well Index. It's used by many stakeholders, researchers and government agencies, contractors and consultants. It really is the basis for all hydrogeologic and geologic mapping. The testimony you heard earlier, the geologic atlases, the first thing they do is they update the county well index. They enter well records that they can find into the county well index, and they use that as the basis for the geologic mapping that the Minnesota Geological Survey does. And there really has not been a ongoing funding source to maintain this database. It was developed, well, it started in the 70s by the Geological Survey, and it's kind of evolved over time. And so we have recognized the need to really update this and bring it into modern standards technology-wise. So there was funding provided in fiscal year 12-13, and one of the things that we've identified first off is there's an enormous backlog of well records that have piled up at both the Geological Survey and the Health Department. About 70,000 were identified, and I actually got an update yesterday. We're closer to 20,000 taking away that 20,000 from that backlog. We also have gathered stakeholder input from all the users to find out what they would like to see in an updated county well index, and we've developed a database structure to house this this new enhanced county well index on into the future. So we're proposing another $780,000 for the next biennium to completely eliminate that backlog. We've actually found that since we started doing this, contractors have come forward and said, "Oh, I got these well records from an old company sitting in my, my storeroom. Can you enter these too?" So we'll probably end up more over 100,000 additional well records in the end. But we'll be able to complete that in the next biennium. We want to develop an online entry capability so that contractors can enter their well logs. They can manage their fees online. We want to enhance the web capabilities. The technology that we have is really kind of antiquated. When you look at our County Well Index online, you can search, but it's really kind of old. Needs really to be upgraded to modern technology. We want to develop mobile applications so that they can view those well records in the field, and they can use those smartphones and things to get accurate locations while they're in the field. And finally, we also will expand the County Well Index to include well sealing records, which are not currently available, as well as scanned images of original well records.
Okay. Representative Kahn, did you have a question?
Yes, I'm interested in, one, Will this request from the Clean Water Fund finish the project is the first question.
Madam Chair and committee members, yes, it will. We have not identified an ongoing maintenance funding source, but yes, this would complete all the updates and enhancements.
Okay, and then the next question is all of this being done under the auspices of MNIT?
Madam Chair and committee members, yes. Now, all of the IT portions of this are being run by MNIT, yes.
Okay, and Madam Chairman, does that also include the updating of the website and so forth? Is all of that?
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, yes, it all of our IT, including the website, is done by MNIT now.
Okay. And also, Madam Chair, I apologize for being late. There was nothing like facing the morning with a 100-foot driveway and a sleeping husband. So,
yes, I. Thank you, Representative Kahn. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was to this point, I apologize, Mr. Elvrum.
Elvrum.
I thought so. Thank you. Your forms that the well drillers fill out, they actually still fill out longhand, and I'm kind of amazed that, and I don't mean to pick on your agency, but I'm thinking of that one in my head, and then I'm thinking of another couple of DNR ones that I recently saw filled out. Why is Representative Kahn has talked about modernizing and moving the IT, how come the well drillers aren't filling that out electronically online? It seems so. You have all kinds of data entry people doing this.
Yes, Madam Chair and the committee members. That is exactly what we want to address with this project, is to make it available for them to enter them online. It has been traditionally a paper-run industry, and I know that even when we do have it available online, there will be some well contractors. These are, you know, husband and wife well contractors that will still want to fill out a piece of paper and send it in. But yes, you know, a majority of them will want to use our online application, and it needs to be done, and it is being done right now as part of this project.
And to that point, Madam Chair, thank you. What about the form that when they send back, and you as the resident, it comes back and says how deep it was, what it all did and all that. Will that form be filled out electronically, and then they can email it to the resident if they want to? It just seems. And then if they do fill it out longhand, will it be scannable by your people so you won't have to? Will that be scannable? And are the ones today scannable so you're not entering the data?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, yes, all the forms will be available. All the forms we currently use, including the well logs, will be able to be entered online and be sent out online. The ones that come in paper, we scan them, but we still have to enter that data. There's no way to make those numbers translate. Okay. Madam Chair, I'll move on then. Mm-hmm. Okay, well sealing is another initiative that we had clean water funding for last biennium, and are requesting again for this biennium. There are 250,000 wells that have been sealed in Minnesota. These are unused, unsealed wells, otherwise known as abandoned wells. But we estimate there's another 250,000 to 500,000 unused, unsealed wells. And the reason we think this is important is those wells can provide a pathway directly down to the aquifers. The geologic layers often provide a barrier to contaminants, or at least some filtering to get down to the aquifer, but these wells are holes that are open all the way down to the aquifer. It could also potentially be a physical hazard, so we really think this is important to get these sealed. With the funding that we had for fiscal year 12-13, we split it up between private wells, and we've passed money to Bowser, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, who's given grants out 9 local government agencies to seal 225 private wells. And then through the health department, we've granted out money to 29 public water suppliers to seal these large diameter, often deeper wells that cost significantly more to seal. And these are all 50-50 cost share grants. We proposed the same amount of funding, $500,000, and would split it again half between the private wells and half to the large diameter wells. The final initiative I will discuss is regarding private wells, and this is a new initiative. 20% of the state's population gets their drinking water from private wells. The location and construction is regulated by the health department, as I've mentioned, and that does provide protection from known contaminant sources at the land surface, septic tanks and other sources that we can identify. New wells are sampled for three parameters: arsenic, bacteria, and nitrate at the time of construction. We find that the nitrate concentrations are relatively low, and we attribute that to the well construction code. Arsenic is found at depth in the aquifer, and the well code really does nothing to protect it. And about 10% of new wells exceed the drinking water standard for arsenic. There's no follow-up sampling required if your well does exceed the standard for arsenic. We send a brochure. We have some limited education. We send a brochure out, but it's really left up to the well owner to take any action to address the contamination. And we also recognize that concentrations can change over time, and that older wells may have never been sampled, or new well owners have come in, and they really don't understand or know what might be in their well. So we are proposing an initiative funding in the amount of $650,000 to do some follow-up sampling in private wells so that we can try to understand what change over time occurs in nitrate and arsenic concentrations. We would sample for some additional parameters, including manganese and radium, which we recognize have some health risk issues. For that additional sampling, when possible, we'd use existing private well networks. The Department of Agriculture has a couple private well networks that are already sampling nitrate, so we just have them sample additional parameters for efficiency purposes. And then we'd evaluate the factors that control water quality in private wells so that we can provide education and guidance to the well contractors so that they construct wells to avoid arsenic and other contaminants, and to well owners so that they know what their risk might be and so they can understand, you know, in what situations would they want to sample and for what parameters, and then what treatment options they will have. So I will turn it over now to Linda Bremer, who's going to talk about our beach monitoring program.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Linda Bremer. I'm the Division Director of Environmental Health. And I want to talk about the final project. It's called Beach Monitoring. The full title of this program is actually Minnesota's Lake Superior Coastal Recreational Waters Monitoring and Notification Program. And this currently is being funded by the Environmental Protection Agency. We just refer to it as the Beach Monitoring Grant. But EPA has notified us that they are not going to fund it, as far as we know, from now on. And I guess the reason what you're seeing here is the map of where the beaches are. There are 80 beaches, believe it or not, along Lake Superior that are visited by thousands of people each year. The purpose of the program is to reduce the risk of disease through water quality monitoring and identifying sources of bacterial contamination. MDH monitors 40 of the highest recreational use beaches. We took over this grant from the Pollution Control Agency in 2011. They decided they didn't want to do the beach monitoring anymore, and I got a call and thought, well, this would be interesting to change the project from a wastewater monitoring project to a public health project to work with the locals and work on education. Two other factors are important in this program. We get teased a little bit about monitoring the beaches along Lake Superior. I'll admit that to you. Might as well put it out there. But what you need to do is look at the Great Lakes as a whole, and these beach monitoring grants covered the entire Great Lakes. I was recently at a meeting with the International Joint Commission, and they are looking at beach water monitoring as a measure of the health of the Great Lake. So I know Lake Superior, again, I've been swimming up there. I know it's not all of our beaches that we use in the state, but think of this in the context of both the national vision of the Great Lakes plus the international relationship for just this piece of the project. It's currently funded at about $210,000. As an annual grant from EPA. What we do is when we take our bacterial samples, public notification, there are postings made at the beach site. There's a website. You can sign up and get automatic notifications whenever there's a beach closure because they find bacteria. This is just a graph of the health advisory days by county. So as you know, the counties that we're talking about are Cook, Lake, and St. Louis. The largest bar on this is St. Louis County, and from getting those notifications, I can tell you that's usually Park Point that gets a lot of notifications for bacteria in the water. Oop. I missed one of my slides. Nope, guess not. I had one more slide about the sources, potential sources of pathogens. Again, we're looking at bacterial contamination in these waters. We are also working on whether or not there would be better indicators of pollution at those beaches to give warnings. And the final thing that group is working on is just, again, outreach to the counties. We work closely with the Natural Resources Research Institute. They do a lot of our website work and a lot of our lab work. So that's the beach monitoring grant. And this is one, as the last one that Chris mentioned, that we're not in the Clean Water Council budget, but they are in the governor's budget.
I have a question about, I think the beach monitoring is an excellent program. I have a question about whether legacy, the constitutional language of the legacy, whether this fits under it. I mean, it's to protect, restore, and enhance. And it looks like this is mainly a public health, unless we're taking it another step to actually do protect the water. So I think we have to have a conversation about that. Because the Constitution this is definitely public health, and I funding it here rather than under just the general fund budget is a question for this committee, I think. Did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. When you're taking your samples of the beach thing, are you testing for the VHS viral hemorrhagic septicemia issue that's on Lake Superior now?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, we're not. It's just bacterial, okay. Not viral.
Could you tell me who is monitoring that?
Madam Chair, I can try and find Representative Erickson. I can try and find out. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
I'll find out for you.
I don't see any other questions. Are there any members of the public who would like to come forth and comment? Good morning. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Tamman from Sudan, Minnesota, an old mining town just a little north of the Mesabi Range. We're about 30 miles from the Canadian border, and it's been very educational testimony today, and I appreciate the comments about doing a groundwater atlas survey for St. Louis County, and I'm a resident of St. Louis County. And I'm not one of those northerners that's going to complain about all the activity down south, because as we see on this map, it's mostly southern counties that have been surveyed. But I think I understand that when you have karst formations, limestone where groundwater can move a mile overnight, certainly that'd be where you want to start. We probably have formations up north where groundwater doesn't move a mile in 100 years. But if you look at a map of the Mesabi Iron Range of northern St. Louis County, we have a lot of faults up there. So it's not a monolithic formation. We have faults. As a matter of fact, there have been exploratory holes, as reported by the Lands and Minerals Department, that have hit 140 meters of sludge in their exploratory holes. That tells you there's a huge fault down there. There's a void down there. We don't know what our groundwater is doing. And having worked in the mines, I know in the past we just buried our grease barrels out behind the plant. And I think it would be a great benefit to the citizens of Minnesota to have this atlas completed for St. Louis County. And if you look at the map, if you did St. Louis County, you would have a survey of groundwater that goes from Iowa to Canada. We cover a lot of north-south territory. And I would also mention as a point that perhaps we should look at as we're having more hearings, we heard testimony today that we have pretty good rules about closing wells, and we're trying to catch up on some of the old abandoned wells. But we also have a lot of exploratory drilling in northern Minnesota that doesn't have the same rules as our wells. These mining exploratory companies are going up there. They're drilling holes in the Duluth Formation, a sulfide ore body, and they're not immediately plugging them. They're allowed to leave them open. And being it's a sulfide ore body, I would hope that we would have somebody looking at cumulative effects. And that's my point. I'm just here as a resident of St. Louis County to urge your support for the Groundwater Atlas. We need it. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that. Anyone else? All right. Well, members, we have completed our work for today, and with that, we will adjourn.